Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
78 minutes in, and poor old Steve has lady problems. So, Hal, fill us in on the details of this thing that we've all run into this situation. I know.
Oh, so often.
After that uncomfortable euphemism, sure. Here we go. All right, minute 78. In the Strategic Scientific Reserve offices, Private Lorraine stands perilously close to Steve Rogers, her hand still on his tie. They owe you their thanks, she purrs. And seeing as they're not here, she leans in and kisses him. Peggy Carter rounds the corner, her eyes narrowing at the sight. Captain, she snaps, we're ready for you if you're not otherwise occupied. She spins on her heel and strides toward the lab. Steve pulls back, flustered. Agent Carter, wait. Peggy doesn't slow. Looks like finding a partner wasn't that hard after all. Peggy, that's not what you thought it was, Steve calls, hurrying after her. I don't think anything, Captain. Not one thing, Peggy retorts, her voice icy. You always wanted to be a soldier, and now you are, just like all the rest. Steve's jaw tightens. Well, what about you and Stark? How do I know you two haven't been fondueing? Peggy rolls her eyes. You still don't know a bloody thing about women. Moments later in the lab, Steve is led by Howard Stark around advanced weaponry. Howard is amused. Fondue is just cheese and bread, my friend. Steve blinks. Really? I didn't think. Nor should you, pal, Howard says, grinning. The moment you think you know what's going on in a woman's head is the moment your goose is well and truly cooked. Me, I concentrate on work, which at the moment is about making sure you and your men do not get killed.
And if I had a nickel.
Sage advice from Mr. Stark there.
Yes, yeah. No kidding.
I'm not sure he took his own advice. I think Howard Stark was a bit of a playboy himself, but he's trying to set a good example for Steve.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow.
So, and that gets me wondering, is there such a thing as cooked goose fondue? You know, some sort of pate or something.
I'll check the index of the book I have in front of me.
Ooh.
Well, what do you know?
Did you bring a show and tell, Brian?
Well, in an audio medium, that's tough. But we can talk more about the movie on the minute if we want. But yes, one of you guys don't know, my wife Karen's hobbies is collecting old cookbooks with great graphics and weird recipes. And so I have in my hand the Better Homes and Garden Fondue and Tabletop Cookbook from 1970. And it is a delight of mid-century modernism and recipes you probably don't want to try.
Lots of Harvest Gold and avocado pots, yes. I would imagine.
Yeah, right on the cover is an avocado green pot with forks stuck in boiling oil. It's fantastic.
Yummy.
Not a sentence I expect to use very frequently, but in my experience in looking at vintage cookbooks, especially from that era, maybe late 50s through the 60s into the early 70s, it was really hard to find one that didn't periodically make use of a Jell-O mold of some kind. And I was trying to think.
Aspic, yes.
Is there anything... is there any way you combine that with fondue? I don't think you could take something gelatinous and dip it in something. I don't think that would work. But
well, not with that attitude.
I guess not. That's true.
It's
self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it?
I'm just Where's not that American can-do spirit?
Yeah. Let me nail some Jell-O to the wall, and then later I'll give it a try. Yeah.
I think it would just melt away, and then you'd have all the little bits of hamburger and hot dog floating in there. And,
right.
Tuna. Yes.
Tuna.
I guess it's fondue, not can-do.
Folks, you gotta. If you're listening to this, you've got to look up the word aspic and check some pictures. It'll turn your stomach. It'll right. Put you off lunch, I swear.
Yeah, we had just had a big conversation about that at work, and the Jell-O mold thing, and then the era of Oscar Mayer head cheese. Just random bits of animal just in gelatin and then sliced like lunch meat for reasons unknown.
Yep. Well, let me set the stage. I'm going to read just a little bit from the introduction here. Fondues Please. Give menus seemingly new and exciting twists, yet the idea originated long ago. Out of a fervent desire to utilize hardened cheese and bread, the Swiss concocted a mouth-watering cheese-wine mixture. I think the word fervent there is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
It really is.
A fervent desire to utilize hardened cheese and bread. It's like, okay. But, you know, that's how all the great foods come about, isn't it? Trying to do something with what you find in the larder that day. I do some of my best cooking like that, but
yeah.
So yeah, it's they're trying to whip up a lot of enthusiasm for here fondue, and the book covers it all, man. We got fondues, appetizers, main courses, desserts. We got we've got all kinds of media. We can do it with cheese, salad oil, chicken broth, beef broth, mushroom sauce, mustard sauce, pineapple sauce. You can fondue anything in anything.
Wow!
Except maybe Jell-O.
Imagine the Better Homes and Gardens test kitchens where they had to try all these recipes out that some lady in Walla Walla, Washington sent to them and said, here, try this. Did you know you can take lamb chops and cover them in cheese?
And there's also multi-ethnic, multinational opportunities, which in this book is restricted entirely to Mexican, but you can do Mexican fondue. Yeah. And let me see. There was one other thing I found here. Okay, here's how you eat a cheese fondue. This is the technique. Are you ready?
Okay.
I'm not, but please don't let that stop you.
Brace yourselves. Each person spears a bread cube, piercing through the crust last. Now, I didn't know that. I've gone through the crust first. With a figure eight motion, he swirls, then withdraws the cheese-coated bread to eat. Then, as the diners continue to dip, the fondue is kept in constant motion, so you stir it as you go. Whoops, who dropped a bread cube in the fondue? He must give a kiss to the friend of his choice. For the person who never lost a bread cube, there's another certain prize, the crusty cheese in the bottom of the pot. So that's how you fondue.
By
Better Homes and Gardens.
So there's an element of sort of, spin the bottle to this?
Yeah.
Or you must kiss somebody? I mean,
well, it was the 70s.
That's true.
I thought you'd be cooking it, and then you'd have to pick who you were going to stick the fork into with their mouth with the hot cheese.
Or maybe, since it's the 70s, you just walk up and drop all your keys in the cheese and see what happens. But, wow.
Yes.
Everybody drops their keys in the cheese, and then whoever you fish out with your fork.
Yes.
That's
the 68 Dodge Dart. I forgot that. Yes. I guess the equivalent of a net cigarette is Cheese Louise. Wow.
Nice.
Somebody has to clean it. I guess the loser gets to clean it up, because trying to peel burned cheese off the bottom of a probably non-Teflon pot would be quite an experience.
But apparently that's a trophy. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Now, I will say, like, when I get French onion soup, if they serve it properly in a big sort of ceramic crock, my wife insists that I save the cheese around the edges for her.
That's the best part.
Peeling it off, and she really likes it. Yeah, it is the best part. That's why I let her have it, because I'm good people.
Back in my fine dining server days, I used to have to prepare French onion soup, and... anything could turn my stomach. It was the smell of Gruyere cheese. I know people love it. I just, the smell to me is, pardon me, hot vomit. So, and serving it every day at dinner was just, I was amazed at how long I could hold my breath while carrying it to a table.
I just always feel so sorry for the dishwashers. I was a restaurant dishwasher for about 2 weeks once. And, so I'm an expert, but, man, I see those French onion soup pots and, They are layers and layers of crust. First of all, I'm not sure it's, hygienic to be eating out of it. But second of all, those poor dishwashers in the back got to try to, get all that stuff off of there. My heart goes out to them, is all I'm saying.
Yes, my daughter used to work at a pizza shop and would have to clean the pizza trays. And she would come home and her hands would be just kind of raw from all the scrubbing with steel brushes. You could eat up a pair of gloves in minutes with the kind of copper scrubbers you had to use on these things. Wow. So just, yeah, definitely not a job you want to move on to your next career from.
Wow.
circling back just briefly as a quick aside, Jim, you mentioned Walla Walla, Washington as the token former Washingtonian in the group. Not everybody believes that's a real place. So I just want to make it clear.
I have stood in Main Street, Walla Walla, under the Welcome to Walla Walla sign.
When I did my cross country for working on my private pilot license, so you have to do a long cross country flight solo. That was one of my stops. And, you know, you can't really look at the place without hearing it in Bugs Bunny's voice or Mel Blanc and some other iteration, but a very real place famous for their excellent onions.
Yes. And not too far from the Hermiston Dam. Grandfather-in-law worked on the Hermiston Dam. So Walla Walla was just a hop over the Columbia to get there.
I did not know that, Hal. And you think I would have put this together sometime in my long, long life, but Walla Walla onions come from Walla Walla, Washington?
That is, I feel like I should say that is correct or something.
Oh,
gosh. Keep the alliteration going, but it's difficult.
All right.
And for the record, I mean, I didn't think for a moment that you weren't aware that it was a real place, Jim, but I remember like prior to moving to Washington and knowing the name of that place from Warner Brothers cartoons, assuming it was probably made up because it's just too much. It's too fun to say.
My connection to it was the Beverly Cleary books, all the Ramona books. I think there was someone moved to Walla Walla, Washington, and Ramona would write to him. So just, it's amazing the fame that place has. I mean, it's not Rancho Cucamonga, but, you know, who can?
I was just going to say Cucamonga. Mel Blanc ruined or celebrated the names of so many places.
Right. Yeah. And it didn't even have a K sound in it and still became popular. So not Albuquerque or Hoboken, but there you go.
And then, of course, there was Johnny Carson, who made many obscure streets in Los Angeles famous. You know, take the Slauson cut off and then cut off your Slauson.
Yeah.
You know? Again, whereas as so often we are showing our age.
Yes.
For those who don't know, Johnny Carson was a late night talk show host. But yeah. So yeah, I'm gonna circle back to this minute just for a second because that's why we're here. But I was taken by Peggy's dialogue with Steve, where she says he's just like all the rest. And to me, that's the deepest insult she could possibly deliver. Her disappointment is palpable that, you know, this guy she championed, this little mouse she turned into a lion, is disappointed her by being just like all the rest, just like all those other mooks back in the bar who were, you know, eyeballing her and getting drunk. And I can only imagine that that's what Steve fears the most, is the idea of letting her down, because she's believed him the whole way and he does not want to let her down.
Yeah, she's basically called him Gilmore Hodge. So it's, it lower than low.
Yeah.
Darn that Private Lorraine.
Yeah, and she might, I mean, you know, and the thing is, Peggy might already understand Steve, but she needs to smack him down for just kissing another woman. It's, she probably could catch the fingernail polish on Steve's tie and figure it out quick.
Yeah, she's, it's interesting too. I think she does a nice job here of displaying a lot of emotions all at once, just kind of the initial shock of seeing Steve and Private Lorraine. And then just, I think there's a split second there where Haley Atwell shows just a tinge of disappointment, and then she firms up and she's becomes the woman of steel and she's in command. I think her veil of command slips for just a tenth of a second. And it's a neat acting moment, I think. A good choice by her.
Right. And very interesting. Of course, they're, you know, in uniform, they're at work, but an interesting choice that she's still addressing him by his rank, you know, and it's not, oh my word, Steve, it's Captain.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think Agent Carter stays surprised by anything for very long.
No, I don't think so either. And you know, it's funny just scrubbing back through it again, because before she walks up, before Agent Carter walks up, Steve is sort of lifting his hands and he's sort of in a position to be pushing Private Lorraine away. But then when we see the POV shot from Haley Atwell and back, his hands are down around her waist and he's kind of, I don't say he's leaning into it, but he's not pushing away either. And that's unfortunate.
He's trying to be polite, I think.
Yeah. That's an interesting observation. That's a good one. A little bit of discontinuity, but it contributes to the character.
Yeah. And there's enough time coverage there that it's not like it's a jump cut or anything weird like that. It's just, it's subtle, but I think it, to me, it communicates, you know, this is happening and he's resisting it. Now she's walked in, but maybe I'm reading too much into it, which I'm good at. But to me, it says, you know, well, at least she saw him pushing the other woman away. Yeah. And then when we see him, oh yeah, he's not really pushing so hard. Oh, no, Steve.
Well, he is a super soldier. If he wanted her away, she'd be away. But
there is that, yes.
Well, you're talking about, I'm also looking through the same, you know, 15-second sequence. And it's interesting that as after the kiss, when Peggy and Steve are walking away, walking toward where they're going, Steve is, he's adjusting his tucking his tie back into his jacket, and he's pulling his jacket down, and he's really recombobulating himself. Like, you know, they were not making out. She did not have his jacket undone, but he's pulling down his jacket, and he's just like, he's kind of overselling it a little bit in a fun way. Like, I've got to get myself together here, you know?
Right.
And he was not that apart.
Completely flustered.
Yeah, he's flustered.
I still wonder about Private Lorraine. Is she in trouble with Agent? Does Agent Carter have any agency over her? I don't know if, you know, she can send her off to the Alaskan, or, you know, send her to Alamogordo. I don't know what her rank is in this thing.
Oh, I don't think Peggy would be that petty.
Wait, Brian, you know women.
Well,
there's a setup.
I know one pretty well, and I have two daughters.
Wow.
Where are you going with that, Jim?
Well, I don't know. I just, yeah. I'm thinking Peggy. Peggy might not take it out, but Peggy didn't, the part that Peggy didn't take out on Steve, I think she's going to take out on Private Lorraine in some future. And not that, you know, not that Peggy would ever hold a grudge. But the other thing that I'm trying to figure out with Peggy is, what's her uniform? Doesn't she usually wear pretty much what everybody else is wearing?
Yeah, she's worn something, you know, certainly something similar with the SSR insignia on it, but she had a skirt and then a brown, like dark brown uniform jacket.
Yeah.
It's just in a white blouse
or dark brown, dark green. Yeah.
Probably a uniform skirt. It looks like to me, but she,
yeah, but she
doesn't
just
have
kinda
any rank or insignia or anything.
Yeah. I don't know if that's maybe the, you know, internal casual, or if you're working in a lab or something, it might be some kind of a, who knows? Anyway,
I'm thinking that the costume department probably had 57 different looks for Haley Atwell, and this is one of them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's just there's so much when I watch these scenes, I want to stay with the SSR. I mean, I know they did it with Agent Carter, but I want to just find out everything that everybody's doing in that scene. There's so many there's so much business happening.
There's guys working on a wall, there's people sitting at desks filling out paperwork. There's all kinds of stuff. It's just fantastic.
They're working on a motorcycle and in the background there. There's just a lot of, as you said, Jim, a lot of very intriguing business going on.
Yeah, and they've got guards and like I was assuming the whole SSR, they're all at the same security level, but they've got guards in front of the, you know, locked rooms. So like, do they not trust their own people there? I guess after the whole incident with was it Schultz? Senator Brandt's guy. They can't trust anybody. And there is in passing the one guy as they first come into that office, the different projects they're working on. One of them looks like the guy's working on the largest automotive fuse ever made. I don't know if you see that in passing, but
yeah,
it's just the
right
thing
there
with
in the foreground.
Two,
yeah.
Yeah. It's like the filament in the middle must be about as thick as a railroad rail.
That does look like a giant fuse. That's so funny.
It's exactly what it looks like. And it's got the Stark logo on it.
Yeah. So just in case it's, it'll eventually short out, but whatever it's going to short out, maybe they were building it to test out the test rack to figure out what the operating voltage is. But quite a thing.
They tried sticking a penny in it, and that didn't work. So after that.
In the back there's a sign that says Armory and Employees Store. Is that right?
Oh,
just the guy with the giant fuse. Armory and Employees Store. Well, explosive store.
Explosive store. That, boy, it was like employees. That makes a lot more sense.
That makes a lot more sense. Yeah. That's where the boom. That's where the boom stuff is. Okay.
Right. It's like to walk in there. Yeah, I need a Colt 1911 and a new SSR polo and matching hat.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to go to the employee store. I get 10% off, right?
I want the SSR branded stuff. Okay, Armory and Explosives makes a lot more sense.
That's so funny. I could still see employees if I just think about it. But as soon as I look a little closer.
I had to zoom in. Yeah, okay. That's where they keep the booms. I got it. That's good.
There you go.
And further back in the restricted thing, I guess, the file clerks don't need to get to get access to the explosives.
It's a nice bit of set dressing, though, because wherever you look in this thing, there's somebody doing something curious or interesting. I mean, there's a guy back there with a weird drafting table. There's guys working on, workbenches and lab benches. And I was kind of looking to see if they'd used any forced perspective or anything to make this space look bigger than it is. I don't detect any. I think it's just a big space.
Back in the file cabinet room, too, there seems to be some kind of a printing press or something that Steve and Peggy walk by. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It looks like some kind of a duplicating machine, but not.
You got to crank off your mimeographs.
I don't know if that is that an early mimeograph? Is that what that is? Or. Because that doesn't look like the mimeographs I knew back in school days.
Smell, the smell.
Yeah, which is something when you try to explain to the kids watching Fast Times what the kids are all doing when they're sniffing their test papers.
It's a nice minute. There's a lot going on.
It is.
And it really sets the feel for the place. It's interesting too that the SSR labs. In contrast to the Hydra Labs, they're more rough and tumble, more relaxed. There's carts full of junk everywhere. Every workbench is full of garbage. And yeah, I got the feeling that back in Germany, Johann Schmidt runs a tighter ship than this. But this is Stark's thing, and it's all about being loose and free and, just working together and figuring stuff out and playing and having fun. I think Stark's a lot about having fun. Because this is fun for him. And Johann Schmidt, the Red Skull, is not a fun fellow.
No, he wouldn't allow teacups and saucers in the workroom.
No. And if something went wrong, you would just be vaporized by a blast of blue, and you don't see Stark, leading that way.
He did not clean up his workplace.
It's also interesting as you go through the two main sets in this minute. I took a stab at counting, but it's a little bit tricky as the camera moves, but there's at least a dozen women working here. I mean, certainly there's some secretaries, but there's a lot of other women just in uniform walking around doing things sort of alongside the men. And it's nice to see, and certainly at least plausible at this point in the war. And not every woman is sitting at a typewriter or giving somebody a sandwich or something like that, as you might expect the stereotype to dictate.
Well, and it kind of makes sense from a real world or a Marvel world perspective, is that if all the guys are off, fighting Hitler, you have the women back at the home front being useful as they can. I mean, it's kind of the wave and whack kind of thing is, well, women can't fly planes into combat, but they can sure fly them to the front, kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And I think I'm imagining if Stark got something to do with setting up the SSR, he just wants the best minds he can get, no matter where he can get them.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interagency operation. I noticed as Steve and Peggy are walking through the clerk side of things, they pass a bulletin board that says Air Ministry Notices. So the Air Ministry is feeding them info, and I guess they're acting as kind of a collation agency where they're collating all the data from different sources to figure out how best to fight. Are they just working on Hydra? Or, I mean, is are they also just fighting the regular German army? Is that also going on?
I think they're just building stuff. First and foremost, they're coming up with gadgets and ideas and weapons and things. So I mean, there's an offensive mission to go find Hydra and continue wiping them off the map. But to me, maybe it's the defensive mission is, how can we soup up this motorcycle? What can we do to this? I mean, there's a nice earthy version of Q's laboratory that's happening here too.
Yeah.
That's Q branch.
It's not as over the top. And
It's now you've got me wishing that Joe Johnston had really snuck a Rocketeer pack into this scene. if it was just sitting on the back bench or hanging on the wall, oh man,
it would have fit in and looked just fine.
And I'm looking hard, and I'm not seeing anything like that. But Joe should have done it.
Yeah, well, it's pre-Disney, so it's just not available from a licensing viewpoint. But yeah, there's so many obvious things you could. I mean. There is a general call in fandom to unite the universes of Indiana Jones, the Rocketeer, Captain America, the Phantom, Doc Savage,
the Shadow, maybe
Shadow, yeah.
All the old Tracy, heroes.
yeah,
Mandrake the Magician, it even Buck Rogers would have fit in. So or Flash Gordon probably more than Buck Rogers. But it would have been, well, we can imagine it's just off screen. It's plausible off screen events.
Absolutely. And I think we've discussed, I know we have offline, maybe we've discussed it on the show or not, but you know, the Disney in Disney Springs, Jock Lindsey's hangar bar, you know, the conceit being that was Indy's pilot in Raiders of the Lost Ark with the snake in the cockpit of the Waco. There are Rocketeer elements there. There's crossover there that Jock Lindsey, after the events of Raiders, he was flying in air races with Chaplin's flying circus or at Chaplin Field and, you know, doing those things that very much crossover. So technically there's some loose, at least on the commercial side, loose canon tying at least Indy and the Rocketeer into the same universe per Disney.
One would hope that Howard Stark has at least visited the South Seas Club when he was in California working with aerospace people.
Exactly. And stolen a coaster.
Yes.
I can neither confirm nor deny that I've either ever stolen one or bootlegged my own. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know why you brought it up.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, this has been quite a minute. We've got minutes to come where we're going to be talking some more. Yeah, I'm sorry to say goodbye to Fondue here. But just to give a behind the curtain, I think we've reached out to many fondue places, and for some reason they just don't want to talk about it. I guess it's just maybe there's secret ingredients or something they don't want to talk about. But
tell the full story, Jim. Where else did we reach out to? We tried real hard to get someone like the mayor of Fond du Lac.
Yeah, and we also tried we've also tried the melting pot. I don't know why the melting pot doesn't think that we are a major marketing opportunity. But someday, you know, maybe they'll come through at the end. We'll find some cheesy bit in this story that we can drop them in on. But someday.
In the meantime, thank goodness for Brian's wife, Karen, and
Garden. Yes. Thanks for bringing 60 or 50-year-old, no, almost 60 now.
1970,
Yeah, coming up. But yeah, something that our grandparents would have used.
I'm just imagining the editors of this book, when they wrote it in 1970, thinking, you know what? Someday there's going to be something called a podcast. It's kind of like a radio show.
Right.
And in the year 2026, people are going to be talking about this book.
Yes. It's a timeless. It's a timeless topic.
Yeah. In a discussion of a film made in 2011, set in 1943. It's,
yes. If they can put a man on the moon, they can talk about cheese and hot oil.
Right.
Well, on that crusty note, thanks for being a part of all this stuff. And if you have your own fondue stories, I mean, by God, we would love to hear about these things. So you can reach out to us. We're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America listeners base over on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.